excited to get back into our study. As you know, we're studying the book of Hebrews, and that's it's a wonderful book, but it is a meaty and weighty book. It is not a lightweight minor league book. It's a lot of theology, and the assumption of the author of Hebrews, who we don't know who it is that you have an understanding of the basis of our faith, the foundation of our faith in Jesus Messiah, and that's the Hebrew foundation of faith. And that includes all the Hebrew stuff, like the priesthood and how important they were, like the animal sacrifices and important that was, and the temple. And so it assumes that you have a general understanding of why those things are so important, and then how Jesus fulfills it all. So you kind of have to come at it with a little bit of prerequisite knowledge and understanding. Either way, it's a powerful book, even if you're hearing it for the first time. So we're going to enter into Hebrews 7, which is one of the more mysterious chapters in the Bible, but we're going to have a lot of fun with it. But before we dip into 7, as we do every week, want to dip back into the previous chapter before we complete a brand new chapter. And there's some cool things in chapter 6. Just really want to focus on Hebrews chapter 6, 19 and 20 for a reminder that we have this hope as an anchor of the soul. For the soul firm and secure, it enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain. I talked about that earlier. Behind the curtain, where our forerunner, Jesus, has entered on our behalf and has become a high priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. Now, the author of Hebrews uses that phrase a lot in the last few chapters. We're going to dig into that phrase. But before we do, I just want to talk about this. Verse 19 says, we have this hope as an anchor for the soul. I said last week, I believe, that we're fortunate to live in the area that we do. Monmouth County, the Jersey Shore. Because without fail, you could be walking along, going into a new park or perhaps a restaurant along the water, random places, and come across an anchor. How many people have seen just some giant anchor sticking out of the sand? It's all over the place. I mean, we have them in Atlantic Highlands where we live. There's one in Keyport. And then what it is, it's a massive anchor from some ancient vessel, perhaps they've salvaged it, and they just kind of stuck it in the sand as a decoration. And what it shows us is what an anchor is. An anchor, this solid iron, bronze, object that keeps a ship stabilized. Now, what we just read here is that we have this hope, the hope of Jesus, as an anchor for our soul. That we don't have to be tossed around with any kind of whim of emotion or even theology, that we have an anchor to anchor us to Jesus. It's strong, it's firm, it's secure. And that is the hope of Jesus, the confident expectation of the hope of glory. You know what we have hope for is glory. The hope of glory is that we'll be with Jesus forever where he is. And so I love that, the anchor of our soul. Before we head into 7, I just wanted to touch at that one more time. So now we're going to go into 7, chapter 7. And in chapter 7, we meet and we talk about, I should say, one of the most mysterious figures in the entire Bible. And it's the high priest Melchizedek. Melchizedek. Now, the author of Hebrews, he has mentioned this Melchizedek multiple times in previous chapters. And he writes about him as being this high priest forever. Well, if you look at the Bible, Melchizedek is really only mentioned in two places with a brief mention in Psalms. So he's mentioned in Genesis 14. He's talked about in multiple chapters in Hebrews. And he's mentioned by David in Psalms, but very briefly. And that's it. That's all we have of Melchizedek. And we're going to study Melchizedek. So we will touch on all three places. But let's just go ahead and start with the first verse of chapter 7, our new chapter, the high priest Melchizedek. Now, I want to remind you, too, that he lived during the time of Abraham. That's about 2,000 years B.C. And Abraham had a very interesting encounter with him. We'll talk about this. But Abraham has his nephew Lot on having his own land and his own family and all his possessions. Well, his nephew Lot was captured by an alliance of four kings, and Abraham rose up and rescued Lot. And when he put everything back together, he got a visit from this Melchizedek. So you need to know that to get forward. All right, starting with verse 1. This Melchizedek was king of Salem and priest of God Most High. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. First, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Then also king of Salem, which means king of peace. Verse 3, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. Okay, so the author of Hebrews, who we don't know who it is, describes Melchizedek in very mysterious and unusual terms that we don't often see, without father or mother, without genealogy. And so it really begs us to look as much as we can at the actual interaction of Melchizedek. Where is it? It's only found in one place, and that's Genesis 14. So let's go there. Genesis 14. Now, let me just give you some background again. Moses wrote the five books of Moses, the Torah, including Genesis. So Moses is writing about what happened to Abraham, and that's 500 years prior. All right, here's what happened. Starting with verse 11, the four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they went away. That really probably got them very angry. Has anybody ever taken food from you and you just. Well, they went away. They also carried off Abraham's nephew Lot and his possessions since he was living in Sodom. Verse 13, a man who had escaped came and reported this to Abram the Hebrew. Now, Abram the Hebrew is Abraham. Okay, just keep that in mind. And now Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre, the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Aner, all of whom were allied with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Okay, so Abraham heard about what happened to his nephew. He's going to go out to the rescue. He had 318 trained men, probably trained men of war, in his household. Now, bear in mind, Abraham's household was huge at this point. His wealth was immense, and he went out as far as Dan. And if you've ever been to Israel, you know that Dan is way to the north. I mean, you can't get anybody that's been to, who went to Israel with us, and we were up at Kfar Blum, and we went up to that region that's like kind of, it's almost like High Point, New Jersey, but it's Israel, Lebanon, and Syria up until Dan, way up there in the north. That's where he went, okay? Verse 15, during the night, Abram divided his men to attack them and routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. In other words, they went even farther than what is now Syria. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. After Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer, the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom, came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's valley. Okay? Now, these next two verses, they're the only verses in the Bible that we see Melchizedek interact. It's the only ones. It's verse 18. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hands. Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. All right, so that's it. That's what we have. That's what the author of Hebrews had. So Abraham, again, he lived about 2000 BC, right, before Jesus. And he'd come to the land of Canaan that God had promised. God said, hey, Abram, you are going to have descendants, you are going to have land, and that's Canaan, it became Israel, and you're going to have a blessing to all the people of the earth, and that's Jesus. So he came here, just as was promised, and he was, according to what we just read, blessed by God Most High. Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High, but not a Levitical priest. And this chapter drives this point home a lot, so you kind of need to know a little bit about this. A Levitical priest, or a priest that comes from Levi. So Levi is Abraham's great-grandson, born probably 200 years after Abraham. Abraham, the father of faith, had a son, Isaac, of the promise. Isaac had a son, Jacob. This is Abraham's grandson, whose name became Israel. Jacob had 12 sons, and they became the tribes of Israel. And one of those tribes was Levi. And it's so written that only those who came from Levi's tribe, those descendants of Levi, could be priests. None of the other tribes could be priests, including Judah, where Jesus and David came from, couldn't be priests. Only this, according to the law, only the tribe of Levi could bring forth priests. So if you wanted to be a priest, the first thing they asked you is, are you from the tribe of Levi? And you say yes. Okay, we could start the process. And Levi wasn't even a priest. In fact, the priesthood didn't exist during Levi. It only came hundreds of years later during Moses' time. So that's what's in play here. Now, at that time, Abraham was still called Abram. And he'd come from Ur and of the land of the Chaldees, and he went to Egypt and lied about his wife being his sister and ended up at Beersheba down in south in the deep desert, ended up coming up to Mamre, which is where we meet him here in Mamre. And this is where he is geologically, geographically, not geologically. Somebody gave me an Israel rock this morning. I'm thinking rocks. So he's living in this region. We have Jerusalem, which at the time was called Salem. Just below that was Bethlehem. Just below that was Mamre, which is really the area of Hebron right now, which is attributed to Abraham. So that's where we are. Now, Jerusalem, as I said, was called Salem. And the valley of Jerusalem, what we call the Kidron Valley, which is right down from the temple before you go up to walk up to the donkey path, you know, the Palm Sunday path up to Mount of Olives, that was called the Valley of Shaveh, or the King's Valley. And that's where this interaction took place. So Abraham had just rescued Lot, his nephew, with his 318 men, and they restored everything. And then he gets this famous visit from Melchizedek. Now, Melchizedek was only identified here as a high priest of God, or a priest of God Most High. He comes in and he presents Abraham with some bread and some wine and blessed him. Now, Abraham responded by giving Melchizedek a tenth of his plunder, or what he had received, according to this text. A tenth. He tithed to him. Now, there's no mention of any conversation between the two of them. There's no mention of any prior history. There's no mention of any later encounters between the two of them. So it leaves us with a lot of questions about who Melchizedek really is, and why the author of Hebrews speaks about him so highly and so frequently. Nobody talks about Melchizedek except for the author of Hebrews. Like I said, David mentions him. The author of Hebrews picks up on that mention and talks about him frequently. So he becomes this very mysterious person to study. But we are studiers here at North Shore Fellowship, aren't we? So we like to study. So instead of going through bit by bit every bit of text, what we're going to do is, because he's in town, ask Melchizedek to come and explain himself to us. Are we good with that? He happens to be here. He's on his way to Perkins. So if you don't mind, please welcome Melchizedek. Hello, Melchizedek.
Hello,
boy. Well, so welcome to our church. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm doing well. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this is North Shore Fellowship. North Shore Fellowship, this is Melchizedek. So we're here to ask you some questions. We're studying you, and I figure, why not just ask you ourselves, because you're here. So first and foremost, like, what do we call you? Do we call you Mel? Do we call you Kizzy? Can we call you Melky Cabrera, like Melky on the Yankees? You remember him?
No, I don't remember him, but people call me either Melchizedek, King of Righteousness, or King of Salem, which means King of Righteousness.
All right, so back in your day, you probably didn't have cordless microphones. And
Are we good now?
Yeah, you had the wired mics, right?
They had to be wired. They didn't have these back then.
Okay. So tell me again. So you're not Melky like Melky Cabrera?
No. I don't know who he is. Okay. But people tend to call me either Melchizedek, King of Righteousness, or King of Salem, which means King of Peace.
Oh, wow. So how did you get all of those titles?
My name is made up of the Hebrew words Melech, which means king, and Zedek, which means justice or righteousness. And since I come from Salem, where I live as king and priest, and Salem means shalom, peace, they call me King of Peace as well.
Ah, okay. So I wanted to let you guys know that during this time of his reign, I was king of Salem, the kings were appointed to different regions. So there would be kings of different regions, and he was in the region of Salem, which eventually became Jerusalem, and they called him king of Salem. Salem means peace. It's like shalom. But they called him the king of righteousness, too. So it's very impressive. You're a very impressive man, but we also have to ask you a very personal question. Is there a Mrs. Kizedek?
No, it's just me.
Okay. Well, if you are a king, how could you also be a priest? And how could you be a priest if you don't have any temple to work with? And you're not even from the tribe of Levi. How could you be a priest?
Well, I'm not a Levitical priest like all the priests in the Bible and the Hebrew faith. I am a priest of the Most High God. I represent him and intercede for his people.
Ah, so is this why Abraham presented his tithe to you?
He presented the tithe unto God, and I represented God at that moment as priest of the Most High God.
Okay, so did you know Abraham before this encounter?
Everyone back then knew him as Abram, which means exalted father, and then later on, the Lord changed his name to Abraham, which means father of multitudes, because from his descendants would come the great nation of Israel.
Oh, that's true. He was the father of Israel. Father Abraham had many sons. Well, so you brought bread and wine to him. Was it because it was Communion Sunday?
No, communion wasn't a thing just yet. This was a common food and drink of the day that you brought to somebody who you wanted to break bread with. However, years later, Moses was given instructions to use these for Passover. And this is what Jesus used when he celebrated Passover at the Last Supper, which is where we get communion from.
Wow. Well, thank you for that. And so why do you suppose you give him bread and wine? And then he tithes to you, because Abraham was really wealthy, and he must have given you a lot.
Well, Lot, his nephew, was not a part of the tithe. But Abraham tithed unto the Lord, not unto me.
I see. Okay. All right, here's a tougher question that puzzles us. What does it mean when the author of Hebrews says that you are, and I'll quote, without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning or days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, remaining a priest forever?
Unlike other kings and priests, my positions didn't come from a lineage or a family line. I am a priest of the Most High God, and I suppose I'll remain that forever.
Okay. Well, one last question. Are you or are you not a Christophany?
Do you mean like related to the famous actor Chris Christophany?
No. That's Christopherson. No, a Christophany is an Old Testament appearance of Jesus. Is that you?
Well, some scholars say that I am, and others say that I'm not. That's just part of my mystery. All I can reveal to you is what is written. I am Melchizedek, meaning king of righteousness, and also king of Salem, meaning king of peace. Without father and mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, resembling the Son of God, I remain a priest forever.
That's it? That's all you're going to tell us about that? I mean, we've been waiting. We brought you here to find out once and for all, are you or are you not? Can't you tell us? Is that all you're going to give us?
That is all, and I need to leave now. So if I leave now, I might have time to get the senior citizen special at Perkins.
All right. Thank you, Melchizedek. Yeah, he's going to get the senior citizen special at Perkins. So I think he's old enough for that. All right. Well, the truth is that on that question, we don't really know. We can look at all the texts that were given and make an assessment. There's scholars that I respect that think that this is definitely a Christophany, an appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament, and others I have great respect for that say no to that. So I can't answer that question for you definitively, but I encourage you to study and seek the Lord. There are things in the Bible that are mysteries that will remain mysteries, and you have to just settle on that. Romans 11 tells us this. Oh, the depths of the riches, of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his ways past finding out. And so we right now we see and know in part, like Paul, but then someday we'll know face to face. But we got a good interview with Melchizedek. I hope he comes back sometime, don't you? All right. Well, the author of Hebrews was very impressed with Melchizedek and wrote some of the great things about him more than any other Bible writer. And in fact, he's the only one to ever mention Melchizedek other than what we read in Genesis and what we're about to read in Psalm 110. Now, Melchizedek the author of Hebrews takes this quote and uses it in his writing, particularly the chapters that we're in. So let's look at Psalm 110, verse 4. And it says, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek." And the book of Matthew says that David quoted this psalm. So we attribute this to David. The author explains the greatness of Melchizedek. And he compares his priesthood, as Melky was just telling us, to the Levite priesthood and how it's different. So let's look at that. Verse 4. "Just think how great he was. Even the patriarch Abraham gave him a tenth of the plunder. Now the law requires the descendants of Levi who became priests to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their fellow Israelites, even though they also are descended from Abraham. This man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi, yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him, who had the promises. And without doubt, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In one case, the tenth is collected by people who die, but in the other case, by him who is declared to be living. One might even say that Levi," listen to how he writes this, "Levi, who collects the tenth, paid his tenth through Abraham, because when Melchizedek met Abraham, Levi was still in the body of his ancestor." So in other words, Levi, who wasn't even born for a couple more hundred years, he paid his tenth through his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. That's what the author of Hebrews is saying. But let's continue. And I want to say again, please don't feel frustrated if you don't fully understand all the details of all these things having concerning the priesthood. We didn't grow up with the priesthood, and that's kind of the point. We didn't grow up having to go to a priest and bring a sacrifice for our sins. That's the point that we're going to resolve at in the end. So just keep that in mind. But verse 11 in chapter 7 says, "If perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, and indeed the law given to the people established that priesthood, why was there still need for another priest to come? One in the order of Melchizedek, not in the order of Aaron." Aaron was Moses' brother. He was a Levite. He was the first priest, the first one that was given the priesthood. That's why the sons of Aaron are considered the priests. "For when the priesthood is changed, the law must be changed also. He of whom these things are said belonged to a different tribe, and no one from that tribe has ever served at the altar." In other words, we're talking about Jesus. He was not from the Levitical tribe. He was from a different tribe, from Judah. And no one from tribe of Judah served at the altar of priesthood. So, verse 14, "For it is clear that our Lord descended from Judah, and in regard to that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests." So Moses, who wrote about and prescribed what the priestly order would be, he said priests will come from Levi, but David and Jesus came from Judah, and there's nothing about them being priests. That's why, you know, this is an important distinction that the author of Hebrew is making. So this is to say this, is that perfection was not able to be attained by the Levitical priesthood of Aaron. And those who came from that tribe, they could be priests, but they did not have the perfection that Jesus brought, because he was a priest in the order of not Levi, but in the order of Melchizedek. Verse 15, "What we have said is even more clear." Is this clear to you, or is this, you know? It's like, more clear? I mean, what are you talking about? It's complicated. No, it's not. "What we have said is even more clear if another priest like Melchizedek appears, one who has become a priest not on the basis of regulation as his ancestry, but the basis of the power of an indestructible life." Okay, so ancestry is what makes you a priest. You can't, according to the Levitical law, like I said before, you want to be a priest, you have to have Levitical ancestors. Your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather all have to be from Levi. "For it is declared," verse 17, "you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. The former regulation is set aside because it is," listen to what he says, "it is weak and useless." Parenthetically, he says, "for the law made nothing perfect. And a better hope is introduced." A better hope is introduced. Better than what? Better than what served as a shadow, not the fulfillment. A better hope is introduced. And he drives this point across because the better hope is what? With which we draw near to God. Look at those words, draw near to God. That's the object of the whole thing. That's the goal. That's the target of creation, is to draw near to God. God created us to be near to us. Sin separated us so we couldn't be near to him anymore. That was the problem. The goal of the priesthood, the goal of the sacrifices, is to get rid of that separation so that we could draw near to God. And that's why there's a better hope to drawing near to God. The author of Hebrews goes on in verse 20, and it was not without an oath. Others became priests without any oath, but he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, again, Psalm 110, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. David prophesying about Jesus. Because of his oath, Jesus had become the guarantor of a better covenant. I like to say new covenant, or better new covenant. And those two words. In fact, I called the sermon better covenant, because that's what it's about, a better covenant. We had a covenant, but it was only a shadow of the things to come. This is the new covenant that Jesus himself talks about. A better agreement. That's what a covenant is. A better contract, a better covenant. So verse 22, because of this oath, Jesus has become a guarantor of the better covenant. Now, there have been many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office. Death stops him. Death could not hold him. Not Jesus, because Jesus lives forever. He has a permanent priesthood. You know how I like alliterations, permanent priesthood, I love that. He has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. See, all this to say that Jesus made a way to save us. He took on the role of high priest, and I often say both the sacrifice and the priest himself, for one reason, to save us. Save us from what? The sin that separates us from God, so that we could draw near to God and he could draw near to us. That's why he did all this. The veil of the temple that was ripped in half, that was a separator. Keep God in and man out. Now that's gone. He lives to intercede for us. And he makes the point that the law, it was complete, and I'm talking about the law, that means the sacrifices and all the things about being a priest and bringing sacrifice, all that stuff. He says it's weak and useless, meaning it's ineffective. He says it's making nothing perfect in drawing us near to God. So Jesus came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it, but to fulfill it as a perfect priest who lives forever and offered us that perfect and complete sacrifice once and for all, living to intercede for us. And I just, I hope you understand the importance of this. Sometimes we, as Christians, present a Christianity that doesn't want to complicate it with the understanding of this. It's just like, Jesus was a good person. You should follow him. If you follow him, then you're a good person too, and live happily ever after. I mean, that is so shallow compared to really understanding what's going on in the foundation of our faith, under the hood, so to speak. This is all that took place. And that it does have to do with Jesus' blood and his high priesthood. So let's end the chapter, last three verses. Such a high priest truly meets our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike other high priests, he doesn't need to offer sacrifice day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. Get this, he sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. He offered himself. For the law appoints as high priest men in their weakness, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son has been made perfect forever. All this to say that Jesus' blood did it all. And that's why we celebrate communion when we do. That's why we talk so much about the cross. It's not a periphery thing. It's central to our faith. What he did means everything. Jesus' blood on the cross, that perfect atonement, paid the price. And Paul calls it the righteous requirement of the law. The law required righteousness and the blood sacrifice. Jesus paid that. The priest, it was just a shadow. It wasn't a permanent fix for sin. Jesus did what it could not do. In fact, Romans even says what the law could not do, Christ did when he gave his life for us. So it's interesting because a few decades after Jesus died and raised, the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem. The same place that Jesus died and rose from the dead had the temple, it's the only one, it was destroyed, never to rebuild again. So even if they wanted to offer sacrifices, even if they wanted to continue the law, they couldn't. They couldn't continue because they don't have what it takes. They need the altar. They need the veil of the temple. They need the Holy of Holies. They don't have any of that. And incidentally, Jewish people, the Jewish faith, had to change drastically. If everything's built around a temple and the temple's gone, then they had to kind of scratch their head and say, oh, now what do we do? What did they do? Rabbi Shammai and Rabbi Hillel got together and said, well, you know, we could make this requirement and add this mitzvah and this and that and make people do this and add more laws and things. And we just replace the temple and with a bunch of laws and then reinvent Judaism and go on. And that's kind of what they did. Judaism without a temple. It seems ridiculous, but they did it. And they did it because they wouldn't accept that the perfect covenant had come into place. Jesus is and was the Son of God. He is the Messiah. He gave his life. He paid the price once and for all, and he settled it. He fulfilled the righteous requirement of the law. And thousands and thousands and thousands of Jewish people received that in that time. That's who we're talking about with, you know, the thousands of people, 3,000 that got baptized on Pentecost, the 4,000 or 5,000 two chapters later, and thousands of Jewish people didn't receive that. And incidentally, the thousands of Jewish people who received Jesus' sacrifice, that movement grew and grew and grew through history. And you know what it's called today? Christianity. That's what it's called today. And it looks a lot different, and picked up a lot of strange traditions along the centuries, but that's the core of it, were Jewish people that believed Jesus is Messiah. It's a better covenant. Jesus' death on the cross was the once and for all atonement for all the sins of all the people. All of us are given, you know, we don't have a temple in Jerusalem, but Corinthians tells us that our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. And Colossians says that Christ is in you. It's the hope of glory. We receive him. And it was his blood on the cross. No goats needed, no calves needed, no holy place needed anymore. Jesus paid it all, once and for all. Hebrews 9:12 says this. He did not enter by means of the blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. Thus obtaining eternal redemption, that means we could all be saved. We could all be saved because Jesus died. And all he says is to believe in your heart that he died, he was raised from the dead, receive his gift of grace by faith, believe, and you will be saved. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. How did he give him? Well, birth, yeah, in the manger, lived, but also gave him as a sacrifice. On the cross, gave him. You know, God demonstrated his love for us that while we were yet sinners, Christ did that for us. And we receive that and say, thank you. Because if he didn't do that, you don't have a chance of getting your sins forgiven, I guess, or at least they'd be covered if you went to Jerusalem and there was still a priest and there was still the sacrifice. I don't know. That was the way, the only way then. Now he made a better covenant. A better covenant, a new covenant of his blood.